KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Trump administration is cutting DEI, or Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion programs. NWPB's Lauren Patterson reports on how that's affecting funding and projects for tribes.
Kylie Probert is a descendant of the Spokane tribe. She grew up in the Northwest and went to college in Washington and Oregon. She landed in Washington, D.C., and in September, she got her dream job, helping oversee grants for tribal communities through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
I wanted to help tribes. I wanted to make a difference in government.
Last month, Probert was fired. She was one of thousands of federal workers whose jobs were terminated during their probationary period. She was managing more than a dozen grants to help tribes across the country.
There was a big push to cut diversity-related projects at HHS. And of course, a lot of my work with tribes fell into that bucket.
The projects were temporarily halted, and Probert says she has no way to verify if the work will be restarted or renewed. Rather than feeling deterred, Probert says she feels reinvigorated, and she still wants to make a difference in public health. That could mean going to an Indigenous law school or finding a new job in health policy. I'm Lauren Patterson, reporting.
A project bringing solar energy to the Wind River Reservation has hit some road bumps due to pauses in federal funding. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman reports, the team is searching for other ways to move forward.
Energize Wind River is poised to set up standalone solar systems and bring electricity to roughly 40 Eastern Shoshone homes. But
the but would be that our construction funding is currently on hold pending review.
That's project director Levi Purdom. He says about $2 million of funding is paused. Even though the project has funding for training, employees, and outreach, it's unable to buy or install the solar equipment. Purdom is optimistic that the funding will eventually come through. But for now, the group secured a $20,000 grant from the Nature Conservancy.
They wanted to support our non-governmental fundraising efforts. So the intent is to hire and fund a fundraising specialist.
Energize Wind River still plans to start construction this spring if they're able to raise enough money. Other tribal nations across the Mountain West are facing similar issues amid budget cuts by the Trump administration. I'm Hannah Haberman.
A Native photojournalist is promoting the idea of a national land-back movement across the U.S. for territories ceded, stolen, or taken during colonization. Joe Whittle is a member of the Caddo Nation of Oklahoma and descendant of the Delaware Nation. A former backcountry wilderness ranger for the U.S. Forest Service, Whittle says he's proposing that the federal government return its public lands to its original inhabitants.
Based on the fact that the United States violated every Indian treaty they ever signed with indigenous peoples, and essentially my project proposes that tribal citizens come together and form a class action lawsuit to sue for damages due for our treaty violations.
Whittle's argument just appeared in Time magazine. He's hoping an inspired attorney might take the federal government on.
There's also an ecological argument based on our traditional ecological knowledge and a lot of data that shows that indigenous people are better and more sustainable stewards of the land than private industry or the United States government has ever been, due to how deeply embedded in U.S. politics private industry has become on public lands.
A presentation and discussion on Whittle's land back proposal will be held Tuesday night at the University of Oregon in Eugene. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios in Eugene, Oregon.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members serve to alleviate poverty while earning money for college and gaining professional skills. Rewarding service opportunities can be found at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Alaskans are losing from uncertainty. Homeowners are potentially losing. Workers are losing. Contractors are losing.
Experts say uncertainty from the Trump administration's federal funding freezes is affecting Alaskans. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 11th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, lawmakers weigh dozens of amendments to a major education bill.
We should ask the question, are the students that are there growing at the end of every year? Yes or no?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If domestic violence has touched your life, know that you are not alone. You have the power to break free and build a future filled with love and respect. There's hope and help waiting for you. For free and confidential support, visit notaloneak.org to speak to someone who's trained to help. Every Alaskan deserves to feel safe. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Alaska experts on energy, housing, and infrastructure say almost three-quarters of $1 billion is in limbo from President Donald Trump's funding freezes, and that uncertainty is affecting local communities. The Trump administration paused funding for several major federal programs back in January. The freeze has interrupted projects in Alaska, like heat pump distribution and building infrastructure that would protect communities from storm surge and tsunami. The disruption was discussed by eight representatives from Alaska-based organizations during a joint virtual press conference today. They said that in total, more than $5 million is at risk from the bipartisan infrastructure law and over $720 million from the Inflation Reduction Act. Those numbers are a moving target, though, given that some programs have been frozen and unfrozen irregularly. Andy Romanoff is the executive director of a Southeast-based organization, Alaska Heat Smart.
Alaskans are losing from uncertainty. Homeowners are potentially losing. Workers are losing. Contractors are losing. And we hope that recent thawing of funds will somehow survive.
One of Alaska Heat Smart's projects aims to install heat pumps in dozens of communities and lower energy costs. But around $40 million of federal funding for that project has been frozen and reopened several times, which disadvantages everyone, but especially low-income families, he says. Tashina Duddle works at Deerstone Consulting, which supports tribal energy infrastructure projects across Alaska. She says many of the grants that are currently frozen for Alaska are slated to fund projects that prevent shore erosion and stabilize villages against permafrost melt, flooding, and extreme weather. One example is a program through the Bureau of Indian Affairs that supports tribally led climate adaptation. The program has allocated $72 million in funding for nearly 40 Alaska tribal projects. It is now on pause.
Without this funding, villages will be lost to erosion. Infrastructure will collapse under worsening climate conditions. Communities will have to relocate without a plan, without resources, and without dignity.
Duddle adds that projects in question create crucial economic opportunities in rural communities. That includes construction jobs. She says that right now, agencies are unsure what projects will be able to move forward and what spending will be reimbursed. And that means that a meaningful construction season this summer is unlikely. Lawmakers in the Alaska House made a few changes to a high-priority education bill Monday and Tuesday ahead of a final House vote. House Bill 69 includes a $1,000 boost to basic per-student funding. House leaders added a variety of policy changes to the bill in hopes of avoiding a veto from Governor Mike Dunleavy. House Minority Republicans spent the last 2 days trying to modify the bill further with dozens of amendments. Four ended up passing. One from Soldotna Republican Representative Justin Ruffridge would place a greater emphasis on students' academic progress when evaluating schools across the state.
When we go forward with our ratings of our Alaskan schools and say whether or not our schools are succeeding or failing, we should ask the question, are the students that are there growing at the end of every year, yes or no?
Another from House Minority Leader Mia Costello, a Republican from Anchorage, would require the governor to introduce a separate fast-track education funding bill at the beginning of each legislative session. That's so school districts can plan their budgets without waiting until the end of the session. It would also require the legislature to pass a school funding bill by mid-March. Lawmakers could still essentially ignore that requirement by a majority vote. But the Democrat-heavy majority rejected dozens of other amendments, everything from boosting funding for correspondence education to capping class sizes and bolstering vocational training. Costello says it's a mixed bag.
Well, I mean, certainly we were happy with the ones that were supported. We're concerned about a few that weren't able to get across the finish line. For example, the reducing class size was one that we really hoped to get passed.
House lawmakers adopted two other changes to the bill. One removed non-binding language saying nothing in the bill or the state constitution should be seen as allowing an education voucher system. Another would allow charter schools to appeal to the State Board of Education when local school boards terminate their contracts. It would also create a charter school coordinator position within the state education department. House Speaker Bryce Edgman, a Dillingham independent, says some of the amendments were good ideas, but the education funding bill was not the place for all of them.
There are many ideas in terms of education policy, as there always has been. Some are controversial, some are not controversial, some are complicated and really require the scrutiny that only a committee process can do.
A final House vote on the education bill is expected tomorrow. Leaders in the state Senate say they plan to act quickly to evaluate and modify the bill before taking a final vote in the coming weeks. Well, a trio of Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race mushers are battling for first place right now on their way to Unalakleet on the Bering Sea coast. Jesse Holmes is in the lead, chased by Paige Drobny and Matt Hull. In Unalakleet, volunteers spent the morning preparing for the teams to race in. Alaska Public Media's Ava White is at the checkpoint and has this story.
Unalakleet resident Cherie Larson is cooking up breakfast for volunteers Tuesday as the group waits for mushers to arrive.
I just love to see the people and be a part of something that is bigger than myself. And having the Iditarod come through here is something I don't want to miss.
She's cooking up sourdough pancakes, eggs, and bacon inside of the checkpoint building, and she hopes the smell of the sizzling warm meal will spread outside, down to mushers on the Iditarod Trail nearby.
When the mushers start coming down the trail, they can always smell the bacon, and that lets them know how close that they are to our stop.
It's the eighth day of the race. In the prior years, a winner was closing in on the Nome finish line around this time. But this year's trail is about 130 miles longer than normal and includes a loop from Caltag, south to Eagle Island, Grayling, Anavik, and Shagaluk before heading back. And mushers say trail conditions on that loop have been awful. Eric Kelly is an Iditarod veteran and is volunteering as a race judge in Unalakleet this year. His job is to make sure everything is running smoothly with mushers, volunteers, and fans. He was expecting a musher by now, he says, but it's been a tough trail.
Everything's running a little slower. The river was, people thought it'd be easy. It's been really tough. It's been a hard, bumpy trail. Yeah, the loop's been rough.
Kelly says Unalakleet is one of the more plush checkpoints. Mushers have access to showers and beds, and community members have a tradition of cooking breakfast. Kelly credits the checkpoint with saving his Iditarod when he raced it a few years back.
Just because of the beds, I ended up staying here 22 hours and rested my team up and finished really well.
On the other side of the room, a large flat-screen TV displays the Iditarod tracker, which shows mushers spread across hundreds of miles of trail. Every once in a while, it updates, and eyes shoot to the screen. Trail crew volunteer Patrice Levine is sitting right in front of it.
We try to keep it on as much as possible. It's been a slow race, so we check it probably every half hour or so.
It's her third time volunteering for the race, and she's been to different checkpoints each time. When a musher comes in, she says it's a rush of excitement.
It really does make it worth it to see the dedication that the mushers have and the excitement in the dogs. I mean, the dogs are so amazing.
And she says she can't wait to experience that feeling again this year. In Unalakleet, I'm Ava White.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Nome's famed Burled Arch gets rebuilt just in time for the incoming Iditarod mushers.
It'll be fun watching the mushers come under it and see how they react to seeing it when they pull into town, especially the veterans.
That Burled Arch is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more.
Start your day with a quick look at the most important stories from around the state with Alaska Morning News, your dose of headlines each weekday morning on your local public radio station.
Alaska state troopers say a shooting last night that left a Willow man dead began as a dispute over carrying firewood. 31-year-old Jared Higgins is charged with second-degree murder and three counts of third-degree assault in the death of 49-year-old John Sabol. Troopers say they responded just after 9 p.m. Monday to the shooting at a home where Higgins had rented a room. Sabol's wife and children had visited to clean and move firewood. The wife told troopers that when she asked Higgins to help with the firewood, he refused, leading to an argument in which they shoved each other. She left and called Sabol, who visited the home to speak with Higgins. Troopers say Higgins told them that after the argument, he armed himself with a pistol. He said that when Sabol entered his room and began to beat him, he shot Sabol once in the abdomen. Sabol's relatives and a resident of the home told troopers that Higgins pointed his gun at them as they tried to perform CPR on Sabol, who died at the scene. Higgins denied aiming his gun at the group. He was being held today at the Matsu pretrial facility. Over the past 2 years, nearly 100 homeless Alaskans died on the streets of Anchorage. The Alaska Beacon reports that Anchorage Democratic Senator L.V. Gray Jackson introduced legislation this week that seeks to codify the rights of homeless Alaskans. That would include the right to take shelter in a public place as long as doing so doesn't obstruct traffic. Last year, a former homeless man turned advocate named T.J. Beers traveled to the Alaska Capitol to urge lawmakers to pass a homeless bill of rights in order to keep homeless Alaskans from being unnecessarily harassed by civil authorities. Rhode Island, Connecticut, and Illinois have already enacted laws affirming that homeless residents have equal rights to housing, medical care, movement, and private property. Last year, Gray Jackson said she wasn't in a position to answer Beer's request, but this year she could make it happen. Gray Jackson, a former member of the Anchorage Assembly, said that during her time in that role, she made a point to visit homeless camps. Anchorage's many homeless encampments are a hot topic in the community, and the city has been in several legal disputes about whether it has the power to remove those encampments. Gray Jackson said she doesn't believe her bill would stop the city from clearing camps. Decades-old proposal to build a controversial road between Juneau and the communities of Haines and Skagway was put to rest in 2016, but that just changed. The State Department of Transportation and Public Facilities is resurrecting the idea that's long sparked debate in Southeast Alaska. The Alaska Desk's Avery Elfelt reports.
The agency is launching yet another study to examine the feasibility of building a road and other infrastructure it says could create cost-effective and reliable transportation. It plans to pay a firm at least $1 million for a new study, due at the end of the year. Agency spokesperson Sam Dapsovich says the road project could also make it possible for Haines residents to get to Juneau and back in one day, and reduce the need for mainliner ferries in the region.
If you knock 14 hours or more out of the mainliner schedule on Lynn Canal, you can do a lot better for some of the other communities in Southeast while even improving the service to Haines and Skagway.
It's been debated for decades. The state has repeatedly studied and pitched proposals, including in the 1990s, 2000s, 2010s, and now yet again. This time, the state is looking specifically at the west side of Lynn Canal. Supporters say the terrain on that side of the canal is less avalanche-prone than on the east side. They also say it would open more of Haines to recreation and provide a more reliable way to get to Juneau, which is only accessible by boat or airplane.
In the years when we first came here in the 70s, the ferry was dependable.
Jerry Lapp is a former Haines mayor and assembly member.
It was very dependable. You could almost set your clocks by it. But it's become so undependable, you can't, in the wintertime, you don't know if you're going to get to Juneau and back.
Many see it differently. Critics argue the road would be extremely costly to build and maintain, in part because each iteration of the road would have also required avalanche mitigation and new bridges, ferry terminals, and shuttles. State officials estimated that the version that died in 2016 would have cost upwards of $570 million. That hasn't changed. Dapsovich says drivers would still need to cross Lynn Canal on a ferry. It could also require a new bridge across the Chilkat River near Haines. Maggie Rabb, the executive director of Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, says she's interested to see the results of the new study.
I'm very skeptical that they're going to learn anything new other than the price has gone up significantly in the last decade and potential environmental impacts have not gone down.
Haines Mayor Tom Morfitt says the money used to study and execute the idea would be better spent on, well, fixing the ferry system.
The road that's made out of water works year-round, and it costs us nothing to build, nothing to maintain, nothing to pave, nothing to plow. If you just stop and think about it for about 10 minutes, the economics become pretty clear.
The state said last week it will accept bids from consulting firms interested in conducting the study through March 25th. In Haines, I'm Avery Elfeld.
So there are no bears on most of the Aleutian Islands, at least not today. But a new study reveals that bears likely lived there thousands of years ago, solving a decades-long archaeological mystery. KUCB's Sophia Stewart-Rossi reports.
In the early 2000s, brown and polar bear bones were found at two historical dig sites on Unalaska and Mackinac Island. But these islands currently don't have bears, and there are no historical records of bears living there. So how did these bear bones get to these Aleutian Islands? Researchers recently discovered that polar bears and brown bears likely traveled to the central Aleutian Island region during the neoglacial climate phase, when sea ice was present in the region. According to carbon dating, the discovered polar bear bones are about 5,500 years old, and the brown bear bones are about 3,000 to 5,500 years old. The bear bones were found in historical dump sites used by Onunga people thousands of years ago. It's been theorized that the bears were transported from a neighboring island that has records of bears. But scientists now argue that likely wasn't the case for a number of reasons. The Onunga people have words to describe bears in Onungam Tenu, their native language. The Aleut dictionary provides terms for white bear in both Eastern and Western dialects, as well as ice bear and black bear. This indicates people in the region were familiar with different bear species. The study also adds that bear stories and legends have been recorded in the Aleutians. Another clue, the bones had butchery patterns, suggesting they were harvested locally. According to the study, bears historically were usually skinned and butchered immediately after death to avoid carcass decay and damage to the bear's skin and fur. Many of the bear bones that were found have cut marks showing signs of skinning, disarticulation, and meat removal. Researchers also found bones from cubs, which indicates female bears with their young were living nearby. The study says female bears with dependent cubs don't travel far. Scientists say further DNA research and ethnohistory are needed to better understand the ancient bear population that once inhabited Unalaska and a Mackinac Island thousands of years ago. In Unalaska, I'm Sophia Stewart-Rossi.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI, providing telecommunication services to tribal health organizations and nonprofit rural health providers, enabling telehealth services for Alaskans. More at gci.com/healthcare. Did you know 100 years ago, the chances of a baby dying in Alaska before their first birthday was almost 10%? Because of advances in public health like sanitation, access to clean water, vaccines for children, and access to healthcare in rural communities, the chances of dying are now less than 1%. To learn more about what the Alaska Department of Health is doing to improve Alaskans' health for the next 100 years, visit health.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
With just days to spare, the Iditarod's new Burled Arch has arrived in Nome as the town anxiously awaits this year's champion. And as KNOM's Ben Townsend tells us, this moment has been a long time coming.
The arch, tightly wrapped in movers' blankets and shrink wrap, was flown to Nome last week. Workers shouted as the arch navigated the tight cargo door of a 737. The old arch crumbled last April after over two decades of being battered by Western Alaska's elements. The Iditarod Trail Committee commissioned veteran musher Ramey Smith to build a new arch, but in keeping with tradition, it couldn't just be made from any old log. It needed burls.
We wanted a tree that had lots of them, so it's basically the perfect tree for the purpose.
Nome's mayor, John Hanlon, says the 27-time Iditarod finisher and log home builder was perfect for the job.
He did a very good job there in selecting a log that will be burned in many people's minds permanently as a representation of not just the Iditarod, but of Nome as well.
The spruce log was harvested from the Chugach National Forest in January, mere miles from the start of the original Iditarod Trail. With its bark removed, the log dried next to a giant wood stove before Smith planed one side of it. Then he carved the iconic inscription, End of Iditarod Sled Dog Race, on the giant 2,500-pound wooden log. Monday, heavy haulers drown out the voices of bystanders as huge piles of snow are dumped on Front Street in Nome. There's a small crowd gathered to witness the new arch, but the view is spoiled by a huge blue tarp hanging over it. Michael Zabel is a pastor at Nome Covenant Church on the corner of Front and Bering Street. The new arch is being set up just a snowball throw away.
It still has a lot of the same symbolism, so it'll be fun watching the mushers come under it and see how they react to seeing it when they pull into town, especially the veterans.
Hanlon says the city will host an unveiling ceremony before the first musher arrives.
Lots of people had a hand in making this happen. I'm very pleased with the outcome, and I'm sure the community, once we actually do the formal unveiling of it a little later this week, that they will be pleased as well.
Hanlon says a robust maintenance plan is in the works to better protect the arch from the elements. He optimistically hopes it'll last twice as long as its predecessor. Reporting just blocks from the arch, I'm Ben Townsend.
The Alaska Moravian Church has begun the process of removing the remnants of an orphanage and boarding school near the lower Kuskokwim River village of Kwikluk, nearly a century after its founding. A small group of church members recently set fire to the main structures on the site, a move they say was long overdue. KYUK's Evan Erickson reports.
On an otherwise uneventful Wednesday afternoon, three men sit on snow machines on a raised patch of tundra looking out toward the frozen Kwikluk River. In front of them, dark clouds of smoke rise up from an area choked with willows and alders, the site of the old Moravian Children's Home. Today, most of the structures that remain are being burned to the ground. According to one of the men, Kwikluk resident Alexander Nikorai, the largest structure that remains was too wet to ignite and will require a return visit.
We tried burning the girls' dorm, that didn't work. That shop, we just burned it down this morning, and then that church, we're burning that this morning too.
2 days earlier, the men also set fire to the iconic three-story boys' dormitory, dating back nearly a century. It was a landmark on the Kwikluk River, roughly 3 miles upriver from the village bearing the same name. In the charred husk of the dorm, relics remain. The metal frame of a tablet school desk, file drawers, snarled inner springs of mattresses, a deformed muffin tin, a backdoor staircase leading to nowhere. At the base of a tall chimney, black letter stenciling reads, MM Dormitory, Moravian Mission, Bethel, Alaska. The buildings, what's left of them, are still owned by the Moravian Church. Just like the Moravian missionaries that established the site in 1926, the decision to destroy what remained of the children's home came from the nearby hub of Bethel. Reverend Clifford Jimmy, president of the Alaska Moravian Church in Bethel, says the church's ruling body, or synod, had discussed raising the property for the past 2 to 3 years.
These buildings are really in bad shape, and the indications of anyone getting hurt was getting so high, so we decided to either have somebody take them down, but burning them was the first option, so we did.
The site was originally known in Yupik as Nunapit Singhak, which translates to Great Little Land. Interviewees featured on a website documenting the site's history describe a complex mix of positive and negative memories. They range from the sense of belonging and discipline the home provided, to the pain of isolation and punishments doled out when residents spoke in their Alaska Native languages. The experiences of those who lived at Nunapit Singhak are not only bound up in the disruptive forces of colonization, they are also closely tied to the fallout of influenza epidemics that predate the children's home and the ravages of tuberculosis that overlap it. According to the Moravian Church in America, in its early years, the home also took in children orphaned by domestic violence, as well as those, quote, deemed unruly. Up until its closure in 1973, the site also took on the role of boarding school and foster home, according to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. In the decades since its closure, the site fell into varying states of disrepair. Nicorai and others in Kwithluk fondly remember 4th of July gatherings there that would bring people from across the lower Kuskokwim region together.
That was when the whole area got together over here to come out here and do the 4th of July carnival, something like that. The highlight used to be when men used to jump in a boat and they'd all line up, 6 or 7, 8 or 9 boats, and then they would row all the way down to that bend down there.
Kwithluk resident David Epchuk remembers visiting his sister and brother-in-law, who were caretakers of the property after its closure.
The last time I went up there was around 1973, summer. I went up there and gave them some salmon.
But in recent years, many say the site became a serious public safety risk. Kwithluk resident Peter Jackson says he went up to the children's home around a decade ago just to check it out.
When I seen everything being torn down, written down on everything, no respect for the people that used to stay there, no respect at all, these younger generations.
Rumors of occult activity, illegal drugs, and teenagers up to no good also swirled. Alexander Nicorai, who took part in Wednesday's burn, says the concerns in his community are real.
Adults, grandpas and grandmas that been hearing about the cult thing, they just wanted us to do this a long time ago.
Whether for negative or positive reasons, in both its painful past and in modern times, the Moravian Children's Home has become a household name across the YK Delta. Soon, it will live on purely in memories. It remains unclear exactly when the church plans to burn the remaining structures, or whether the local native corporation that owns the land has plans for further cleanup or recovery of the site. It did not immediately respond to a request for comment. With reporting from Samantha Watson in Kwithluk, I'm Evan Erickson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Alona Niden and Chris Clint in Anchorage, Eric Stone in Juneau, Ava White in Unalakleet, Avery Elfeld in Haines, Sophia Stewart Rossi in Unalaska, Ben Townsend in Nome, and Evan Erickson and Samantha Watson in Kwithluk. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. We had production help from Wesley Early, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
The Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, located in downtown Fairbanks, featuring hot breakfast, Wi-Fi, and a fitness center. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
Thank you. like throwing faces at the sky, like throwing arms round. Yesterday I stood and stared wide-eyed in front of you, and the face I saw looked back the way I wanted to, but I just can't hold my tears away the way you do. Please believe I never wanted this. I thought this time I'd keep all of my promises. I thought you were the girl I always dreamed about, but I let the dream go, and the promises broke the make-believe that I.
swirling dust fly up off the truck tires down a dirt road in Nashville in the summertime in 1996. I was listening to my dad and Johnny Cash doing Chain Gang and talking trash with Savannah and smoking cigarettes. But it wasn't that long till I tasted the salt of the sea, that she was still in love with the guy she left for me. So she stood there crying as I packed my pack, and I knew that I was lying when I said that I'd be back.
So here keeps on rolling down the road.
To about 2003, I'm standing on the corner of Hollywood and Vine, just a six string and me in that Capitol building, looking up at that thing, wondering when am I gonna get my chance to sing. But faced with that kind of predicament, it'd be pretty hard not to get choked up. When every hero I had has died and every band I had broke up, I'm invited to a party and I just can't come, cause I know that once I'm in, I can't pull out till I'm done.
It's all real, it's all rolling down the road. It's all
last 9 or 10, old Apuk waltzed in, put a slimy gun to my head and said, son, this is the end. I said, you better get back, I got an army of good friends who would follow me to hell, and I've done the same for them. Besides, you're not gonna destroy what we worked so hard to defend. We protect the things we love, just like our families did. We picked a long and winding course, and we'd do it again. We picked a dark horse, and we're gonna ride it to the end.
It's all real, it's all rolling down the road.
pakikain kabaya e kata mangga mangga muda manis mangga datang dari hila kata nona nona hitam manis bikin nyong syo jadi gila sungguh bagus. Si nona hitam manis, hitam manis, hitam manis, celili.
Come on, come on, come on.
Well, I was sitting, waiting, wishing you believed in superstitions. Then maybe you'd see the signs. But Lord knows that this world is cruel, and I ain't the Lord, no, I'm just a fool. And I'm loving somebody, don't make them love you. Must I always be waiting, waiting on you? Must I always be playing, playing your fool? I sang your songs, I danced your dance, I gave your friends all a chance. Putting up with them wasn't worth never having you. Oh, maybe you've been through this before, but it's my first time, so please ignore the next few lines, 'cause they're directed at you.